originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal. I'm sitting here in our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio, and I would like to thank everyone listening tonight here on the Horse Racing Radio Network on Sirius 219 XM 206. Also, to those of you listening to our website at horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to former riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. Please, if you're able to help, visit their website at www.pdjf.org. So my guest this evening was one of racing's pioneers. She was the first African-American female jockey. She was also the first female jockey to win 5 thoroughbred races in one day at a major racetrack. She rode mostly in California, had over 750 winners. It is a pleasure to introduce jockey Cheryl White. Cheryl, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, Cheryl, for taking the time out of your busy schedule. I know you're a racing official now, is that correct?
Yes, I have been for many years.
Many years. And where are you working at now?
I work the California Fair Circuit, and I'm currently in Albuquerque right this second. Oh. And I work in Ohio during the winter.
So you travel everywhere. You're still a gypsy.
Yes.
Now, you're a racing official. Now, what is your position at these racetracks?
They're all different. In Ohio, I'm in placing. On the fair circuit, I've been clerk of scales, placing, patrol judge, all kinds of things.
Which one is your favorite?
I think I like being the clerk of scales mostly because being an ex-jock, I kind of like being in the jock's room.
I always thought that would be a cool job to have. You're still there in the room with the jocks and the hustle and the bustle, and you still feel like you're part of it, I'm sure. And Cheryl, I would love to, now let's delve into how you first got involved in the sport.
I grew up in the industry. My father was a jockey before I was born, and he was a trainer. My mother owned horses, so it was just a natural flow, I guess.
Your father was a jock, so where did he ride mostly?
You know, I don't know, because he was training by the time I was born.
Oh,
but
okay.
I've never really looked into that or ever asked him. I just know he did, because he was galloping until the day he died, so he was 84.
Wow. So he loved the horses. He loved being on the back of them, especially, sounds like. And do you know how long his career lasted? His riding career?
No, I do not.
How about his training career? How long did he train for?
Well, he had a couple horses in the Kentucky Derby before I was born. And so he died in 86. I believe he was 84, so his career training at least had to be close to 40 years.
And he had horses in the Derby.
Yeah, I found that out when I went back to Kentucky for an honor, and the journal there did an article on me, and the gal had dug up that he ran two horses in the Derby. I think it was 53 and maybe 51. I'm not sure. I'd have to look it up.
Yeah. And your mother was also involved, so it was kind of natural for you to just follow that same pathway. And what did your parents say when you first announced that you had this idea of being a jock?
My dad was an old-timer. He didn't believe in women riders, you know, but and he wouldn't let me start riding until I graduated from high school. But I think after I started and I did really well for him, it changed his mind. Then he used women riders frequently, I think.
Wow, so you broke the mold there. He did not believe in women riders, and his own daughter wanted to ride and finally convinced him that we were obviously capable. And Cheryl, so when you first decided to ride, what brought you to that decision? Was it just being around the track, galloping horses, and you just thought, hey, this is something I want to do?
You know, I don't know. I had intended to go to college and become, I wanted to teach algebra. So I don't really know where it changed, because right about that time, women still were not allowed to ride. But they were allowed to drive the trotters. So I thought about that too, but I never did experience that. But in 69, women started riding, and I don't know, it just came up. I was very good friends with Mary Bacon my last year in high school. She was riding there at Cleveland. And I don't know, it just floated that way.
It's funny you mentioned you had intended to go to college to teach algebra. Cheryl, I decided to ride to get away from algebra. That was the last thing I wanted to do. I was terrible at math. All I could do was a quarter pole, the half mile pole. That was about it for me. But so Mary Bacon, you're friends with Mary Bacon, and women started riding, and you had the idea that you could do it too. And so tell me about the process of first getting your license. It had to be difficult in those early days.
Well, back in that time, you could gallop. You could work on the racetrack for your parents. You know, you get a work permit. So I was galloping long before, in this day and age, that you are allowed to get a license. Plus, I rode at home. I was probably a kid that could ride before they could walk. But I had been licensed as an exercise person for a few years by then, and so I had to get okayed out of the gate and approved by other riders. But I grew up there at Thistledown, so everybody knew me, you know, as a brat, backside brat. But my father wouldn't give me a horse to get okayed out of the gate with. He said I wasn't ready. So I went and found my own, which was an experience, but it turned out okay.
Wow. So he wouldn't let you. Wow, that's crazy. And so you eventually found a horse to break out of the gate with, and they gave you your license. Do you remember your first race?
Yeah, my first race, I packed the grandstand at Cleveland, more than it had ever been packed for the Ohio Derby back in that day. Mm-hmm. And Kim Sawyer was riding there the same year, and she had a horse in my race, which flipped in a post parade, because when they made the announcement for me, the crowd I guess got loud and scared her horse, and her horse flipped in the post parade. So I was worried whether she had gotten hurt or not, because we were friends.
And the
but the horse couldn't. The horse couldn't run much. She broke fast, about 3/8, and then run last, I think.
Hey, Cheryl, nothing wrong with that. I ran dead last in my first race too. That's how it goes, right? But the grandstand was packed. And what was The reception of the fans there, were they eager to see you ride, or was it skepticism? What was the feeling?
I think that it was really good. I think that that's part of why the crowd, you know, was so loud when the announcement was made, you know, referring to me. And I think it was a good reception. And if it wasn't, I was probably oblivious anyway, you know. I never paid a lot of attention to a lot of stuff till I was old enough to appreciate that I hadn't.
And did your dad watch? What did your dad say?
Oh, my dad, he was good. You know, he was always a smile, always in his white starched shirt and a necktie every day. But it was good. It was his horse, obviously.
Yeah, I forgot to ask you, did you have any brothers and sisters?
I have a younger brother. He's in the advertising business.
So he didn't go to the racetrack?
Yeah, he did. I after I was gone, there's 9 years between us. So, but he hustled book. I think his feet were too big to gallop for very long. So, but yeah, he dabbled around the racetrack some.
And then he got away from it, and you found incredible success. So you rode your first race, and how long did you? Did you ride most of your career there at Thistle Downs?
No, I started at Thistle Downs, and I rode in that area. I won my first race at Waterford Park, which is now Mountaineer, and because we shipped up there quite a bit. And I rode all around there, Finger Lakes, Penn National, Commodore, Hazel Park, Liberty Belt, a lot of the tracks in that area. Back then, there was probably 20 tracks within a 100-mile radius, so there's always somewhere to go. And then I left there in 74. I went to California and stayed there ever since.
So you won your first race at Waterford Park.
Yes.
And describe that race to us.
I don't remember.
You don't remember?
I mean, I remember the horse's name, Jet Alera. He was a gutty little old fella that my dad owned and trained. And, in fact, I won my first and my fifth on him, which constitutes starting your bug.
Right. So your dad had to be pretty happy with that. And then you, like you mentioned, you won your fifth race on that same horse. And that's when your bug starts, which you have a year with that bug weight, which is obviously an advantage, which is why so many people like riding the bug, because they get the weight off. And did you have pretty good success there with your bug?
I think so. I lost it. You know, you get it for like 100 wins or a year, whichever comes last.
Right.
And I had the 100 wins, so I guess that constitutes doing okay. I wasn't one of them people that had the bug for 3 years.
No, I would say that's definitely okay, Cheryl. And how was the reception of riding for other people other than your father?
I think it was good. You know, like I said, I was a kid, and I didn't pay a lot of attention to a lot of things. But I did okay, and rode for a lot of different people, and I think they were happy, and I don't think there were any complaints.
Jockey Cheryl White is joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Cheryl, obviously when I rode, which was 2009 to 2014, so much has, you know, women are much more accepted around the racetrack versus when you started. And even still, I have had not many, but a couple people just outright tell me to my face, I don't ride girls. Did you get that very often?
not often, but I did get it from one quarter horse trainer, which actually surprised me because we were at LaSalle, and it was Connie Hall. Because back in that day, Tommy Swan was one of the leading riders, quarter horse-wise, and she's a very good quarter horse rider. And Tommy must have been the person that Connie got upset with and would never ride women riders, because she had horses open, and she was dating a person that I had rode for and had been successful for. And she had horses open a couple times, and I tried to get on them. And finally I just asked her, I'm not bad, you know.
Right.
And she told me she wouldn't ride women riders, just flat out.
Wow.
She didn't really explain it, but she's pretty much about the only person that I think I've run into point blank that has stated that. I mean, I'm sure there's lots more around, but they don't really state it, at least to the women rider. Maybe their agents or other trainers or something. But,
right.
You know.
So just flat out told you, nope, don't ride girls.
Yeah.
And for me, when someone would tell me that, it always just created this burning desire to beat them in the next race, obviously. So I would do whatever I could to make sure at some point I would beat them, and then I would show them. And then, of course, I'd try to go back to the barn and say, hey, now, how about you give me a shot now? Of course, you know, they never did.
Yeah.
But
where'd you ride at?
I rode out east. This happened mostly, I remember the one particular person was at Parks. I found that it would kind of depend on the racetrack and how well women riders did. That would determine how they received women riders, I suppose. So I found that happened once at Parks. Now, Maryland, they love women riders, and I ended my career in Maryland. But yeah, it always just, it made me so mad when they would say that. And how did that make you feel?
I don't, like I said, I don't think that I ran into it that much early when I was young, but at the same token, like I said, I didn't pay any attention to much of anything. I was just going about my thing, you know, enjoying what I was doing. I had a passion, and I was fortunate enough for my livelihood and my job to have been a passion. And so most stuff just bounces off of you when you're a kid.
Yeah, and that's true. That's true. And you mentioned your dad made sure you graduated high school before you rode races. So were you 18 when you first started riding?
17.
Wow, that's so young. My goodness, right? It's so young, but
yeah.
We loved it. We loved it. And did you?
I could have rode a year before, though, but he wouldn't let me.
Wow. He wouldn't let you. Now, Cheryl, did you have, struggle with your weight at all?
Not really. I didn't have any, I didn't have a weight problem when I was riding. I had a little bit of one. When you start, back then, when you started with the bug, it was a 10-pound bug back then, and horses got in with the bug, would get in like 101, 104 and stuff, and when I was a junior in high school, when I was running around friends with Mary and stuff, I had been somewhere around 120 in school, and then that summer I got down to like 101, and then when I went back to school, I thought, I stretched my stomach back out, went back up, and figured, no big deal, you know, it was easy to lose last year, I'll lose it, you know. Well, it's a little harder because a lot of weight is psychological. And so it didn't come off quite as easily when I needed it to come off. But then when I rode at Toledo, the wind chill factor was 30 below, and it was a 60-day meet, and 90 horses went down at that 60-day meet. And somewhere along the line, I think they just stopped weighing us. They were glad to have people riding.
Yeah.
And from the moment that happened, I never had a weight problem again. it went down. You know, I mean, I guess it just the getting rid of that mindset that you had to worry about it.
You're so right. It is psychological, and never really talked to someone who said that. It's so true, and it's funny because when I rode, I did struggle with my weight, and now that I've retired, I'm not much heavier and I eat whatever I want. And it's strange how your mind works. And when you force yourself not to eat and then when you allow yourself to, it's strange how the body works and how the mind works. But yeah, it's definitely, that's light too. You mentioned the 10-pound bug, 101 pounds. I'm glad I never had to attack that. I can tell you that much.
Well, you know, nowadays, even if the states that still have the 10-pound, 10.75 pounds, it's the weight thing for the horses is so different anyway that even your 10-pound bug weight is only around 113, 14, 15, you know, so it's not, you know, they've changed the weight scale for the horses and stuff, but I don't know, back then it was different than it is now.
And do you think that makes a big difference? For the horses, taking that weight off?
Geez, I don't know. Every race is different. Some people don't believe in a short race that it makes a difference. Some trainers would rather have the dead weight that's not moving around on a horse as opposed to the live weight. I think you'll get all kinds of different answers on that one.
Yeah, I myself personally think live weight is much better than dead weight because you're actually moving with the momentum of the horse. But like you mentioned, everyone has their own opinions. And so, but, you know, I do think the difference maybe is in the fact that a 10-pound bug is maybe obviously less experienced and they just let everything run. So, you know, obviously that can make a difference as well.
Yeah, they certainly do tend to have different hands on horses than older, experienced riders and stuff. And
Cheryl, in your early years especially, did you have anyone there in the room who kind of took you under their wing? You mentioned Mary Bacon, but did anyone else in the room kind of try to show you the ropes?
Mary wasn't around when I rode, when I started riding, but... Yeah, I started where I grew up, and all them guys, a bunch of the guys rode for my dad, and they saw me grow up, and so I don't really necessarily think take you under your wing thing, but they were receptive as far as my trying to start, I think. I don't really remember running across anybody that was you know, a jerk or anything, and they would give you, you know, they would tell you anything or that would help you, or if you asked, answer your questions.
And how about when you're preparing for a race, did you do a lot of handicapping, or would you try to always make sure you work the horse in the morning?
No, I don't really care that much about it. I think that I part horse, so I think that I can communicate with a horse well. If I did gallop it any number of times, I thought that I was astute enough to be able to pick up on things about the horse. But mostly I tried to follow trainer's instructions. Mm-hmm. Because regardless of whether they get beat or not, it's always going to be the jock's fault. But if I followed their instructions and I know I did what they told me, I know that it wasn't my fault.
Very true. Very true. And how would you describe your riding style?
Adaptable. I could adapt to whatever the horse needed or the race, whatever it. You know, like they say, some people are front riders or come from behind, whatever, you know. I think that I was sharp enough and adaptable enough that I could go with the situation.
Obviously, that's very valuable in a rider. Did you have a preference, though? Did you maybe prefer to be on the front end versus coming from behind?
I think the easiest horse to ride is one that comes from like 7 to 10 lengths out of it. Assuming that when you step on the gas pedal, they go.
Right. Exactly.
You know,
I always.
It's an easier race for a horse, too, if they come from out of it.
I always love that rush you would get when you're turning for home. And like you mentioned, you're a couple lengths off the pace and they kick in and you're just passing everyone left and right. That's the biggest rush in the world for me. Anyway,
yep.
I love that feeling. Love that feeling. And Cheryl, were there any riders around that time that you really liked the way they looked on a horse, or you really liked their style? And did you watch anyone and try to emulate their style?
You know, I don't think so. As I mentioned previously, I was a kid. I wasn't paying attention to much of anything.
Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with
I
that.
I told you, I'm not good at this.
You're very good at this, Cheryl. Come on now. And who were some of the riders you rode with?
Well, I rode for 21 years, so there's quite a few. On the West Coast, Pinkai and Delahousie and McCarran and, you know, all those guys. I had tons. I mean, as far as your name riders, it would have been the ones, you know, in California mostly. I didn't get anywhere. I mean, I didn't go anywhere at the big tracks, basically, when I was still back here. I went to Liberty Bell. I don't even know what track that is now, if it's just changed names or extinct.
Right.
But the only time I went into Churchill, the plane, when it landed, they canceled the races because of snow weather.
Oh, no.
So I didn't really go, you know, too many places that I remember. You know, name riders other than your California guys.
All right, Cheryl. Well, let's take a quick break. Folks, stay with us. You are listening to Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Pena, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I am joined tonight by jockey Cheryl White. Cheryl, before we went to break, we were talking about some of the different riders you rode with and all of the different racetracks you've been to. What's your favorite racetrack to ride at?
One where I'm winning races.
That's a very good answer. Very, very good answer. Would you say maybe one stuck out in particular that was just a beautiful racetrack?
I didn't ride there long. It was mostly in and out for the women's race. I thought that back in the day that Atlantic City was one of the most beautiful racetracks there was.
Atlantic City. I had the... I was able to ride there a couple times myself, Cheryl, and you're right. And, of course, when I rode there, it was kind of, you know, I guess you could say falling down a little bit. But the turf course is absolutely beautiful, and that longer grass. And I loved riding there. And
it was just really pretty. It was, you know, back in the day, the boardwalk was still there, you know, it's not the casinos and stuff. I mean, this was way back when. You know, they had that race for women riders that they brought in from all over. I forget what it's called, Boots and Bows or something. And it was a very beautiful racetrack back in its day.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that Boots and Bows handicap. And you actually upset that race one year, is that right?
Yep.
I love it.
Yeah, I won it. I think Mary thought she was supposed to win it, or Robin thought she was supposed to. One of them thought they were supposed to win it, but yeah, I won. I think the trainer set this horse up for that race.
Nice.
They had a party the night before and told me I was going to win, and I'm like, yeah, okay, you know.
I love it. I love it. And yeah, I guess you said someone else thought they were supposed to win the race, didn't they? They were pretty angry after the race. Is that right?
Are you talking about that BS from that book?
I read it online. I read it online, Cheryl.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, right. It was Mary.
It was Mary? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what counted is that you won the race, right?
Yep.
That's all that matters. She got over it, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. That's, you know, it happens. But, you know, like, she was the, her and Robin were the famous ones, you know, so I guess they expected, you know, I don't know. They just thought they were on the better horses, I guess, but didn't work out that way. Any horse can be beaten on any given day.
That's exactly right. That's why they have gambling, right?
Yeah.
Now, Cheryl, I would like to now talk about your career on the West Coast. And I myself never rode on the West Coast, so I'm very interested to hear your stories from out there. And when did you first decide to travel out west?
I actually went out there to visit friends like Kim Sawyer, who I rode with. She was from Hammett, so her family, you know, they were out there, and I think I ended up going out there to visit her, and then another ex-rider, Sandy Schleifer, and she lived from California, and I ended up staying. I galloped a little bit at Pomona, and I happened to be there when the fair rolled around. And I rode some there, and I rode, I did good on a couple of Appaloosas there. And a lady that trained Appaloosas, Betsy Wilson, asked me if I wanted to stay and ride for them the next summer on the fair circuit. And so that's how it started.
Appaloosas.
Appaloosas.
Well, you did very, very well riding Appaloosas. And
I think so.
Yeah, I do believe what I heard anyway was that you were the leading Appaloosa rider in America for quite a while. And
I think five times. I'm not sure.
That's pretty impressive. And what are they like to ride?
They're just like horses. Everybody says they're crazy, but it's not the horses. It's the people that, you know, were training them. You know, they were a new breed, and you got new people that really weren't trainers like what we're used to dealing with, trying to teach them, and so they got a bad reputation. And most of those appies were 15, 16 thoroughbred anyway, so that kind of takes that out of the equation.
So besides thoroughbreds and Appaloosas, what else did you ride?
Quarter horses, Arabians, and a couple of paints thrown in.
So I worked one quarter horse out of the gate. I never rode a quarter horse in a race, just in the morning. And that's an incredible feeling, to be on a quarter horse breaking from the gate. Did you enjoy riding those?
I enjoyed riding winners, and I did good. I was very good out of the gate, and so I think that helped quarter horse and Appaloosa people navigate to me, because they're shorter distances, so out of the gate sometimes is important. And you'd be surprised how many people that ride thoroughbreds can't really adapt well to quarter horses, like as far as switching your sticks and stuff.
Really?
Because by the time they think about switching their stick, the race is over. So it's just funny to watch some of the guys that just can't adapt to them.
You have to be pretty quick, I'm sure. And you mentioned earlier how you were good at adapting. And I want to ask you another question for our listeners. How do you get so talented at breaking a horse sharp from the gate?
You know, I don't know that you get. I think that for myself, I just think that it was a natural thing. Like I said, I think that I'm part horse. I'm also very relaxed. I was probably more apt, if I was going to get hurt in the gate, because I would stay on one probably longer than a lot of riders do nowadays. You see a horse twitch their ear and they're off on the platoon. But I think a good portion of it is being relaxed. Horses, everything that goes through your body generates to the horse. And so I think that was a good portion of it, being able to be relaxed and in tune with the horse.
Well said, Cheryl. Joggy Cheryl White is joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Cheryl, in July of 1971, you were on the cover of Jet Magazine, and that had to be a pretty cool experience.
I guess, but I still go back to that. I was a kid thing. I didn't keep anything. You know, later on when I appreciated that fact, and then it took me a while to try and hunt down a couple, because I didn't keep anything. I didn't care. You know, it was good. And now I have a copy of it. And reading the story, it's kind of crummy. But it was an honor and everything. But back then, you don't really appreciate stuff like that. You know, like you said, I was 17 or something, you know, and somewhere along the line, all the publicity was good, but after a while, you know, it's the same questions, the same this and that, and then they come and they want to do a little take about women in sports that shows between movies like we used to go to in the drive-ins and stuff, and then they're filming it, and they wanted to wait, they wanted to catch the sunrise, so they made you get up, catch the sunrise, and then we ended up waiting till 9 o'clock so for the sun to be in the right place for the filming. And then they wanted you to walk the horse on the wrong side of it.
Oh, wow.
Because of the camera, I'm like, if anybody sees this, they'll think I'm stupid, you know. But it's just things like that. They send people to do things that don't know anything about horses and stuff. And then somewhere down the line, Ebony wanted to do an article on me. And I guess Jet and Ebony are owned by the same company. And by that time, I guess I had my fill of it, and I asked how much I was going to get, and they said, oh, you're going to get free publicity. I said, I've had all the free publicity I want. Thanks, but no thanks.
Did you know, after that came out, after that magazine came out, did you get a lot of people coming up to you asking for autographs and things like that?
You know, it's funny. I still have people ask for autographs. I don't remember. I mean, I've always had people, you know, that the racetrack is like a world of its own. And so regardless of where you go, you always run into somebody, you know, that you know or have been, you know, a part of at some point. And I don't really remember whether that caused an influx in things. Mm-hmm. But the autograph thing, it's amazing and cool that people still want it.
It's understandable why they do, Cheryl, as we are finding out right now, spending the hour with you. And now I want to talk to you about, as I mentioned in the introduction, you won 5 races in one day at a major racetrack. That's a pretty good accomplishment there. And they were thoroughbreds. And when did that happen and where?
I think it was at Fresno, but I'm not for certain. It was a great accomplishment, especially for California. You know, when I went to California, technically, California's behind the times for women riders, even back then. When I left the East Coast, or mid, whatever you want to call Ohio and Pennsylvania and stuff, there was always 5 or 6 women riding in any track I was back here. And then when I went to California, there was 1 woman riding up north and 1 woman riding down south. And California don't accept women that well, I don't think. I'm not certain they still do. I mean, Chantel's doing okay, and Julie did okay when she decided to try it there, but she'd been there for a couple years after retiring. Had she came to California in her heyday when she was doing so good in New York, I don't really believe she'd have done any good.
Wow.
California's just a strange, you know, I don't know if it's the money, mm-hmm. you know, or what it is. I think that in order for a woman to do exceptionally well in California, there has to be a trainer with a big barn that his owners let them do what he wants to do, and he makes that his point. And then I think somebody could have great success, but until that, you just dabbling.
Yeah, it's difficult there, very difficult there, and
I just don't know why though.
Yeah, and like I said, in my experience too, it did depend on which racetrack you were at, as far as how receptive they were of women riders, and it sounds like California it didn't really catch on. So
no, it still, I don't really think it still has. I mean, yeah. I probably rode, I don't know, 10 or 12 horses at the major meets there, Del Mar, Santa Anita, Hollywood, you know, and the closest I got was 15 lengths, within 15 lengths. And not that it's any great shakes, but it's just hard to get decent stock, and you know, and thank you for the people that gave me a shot, but most of those people you know, they didn't have anything that could run a lot. And so, like I said, 15 lengths was the closest I got to the front end. And I learned quickly. Being I'd rode for 3 years, it was no big deal. And I rode with a lot of good riders there. But I didn't care to be a small fish in a big pond. So when I had the opportunity to go to the fairs, and it worked out very well for me, so I learned to be a big fish in a small pond quickly.
Well, and that what you mentioned about California makes that accomplishment of winning 5 races in one day even that much greater. And Cheryl, I do want to ask you, you won, was it the 5th winner you won for your mom that day?
It was my dad. I think my dad owned that horse. It was Jet Allaire. It was the same horse that I won my first race on. I think my dad was down as the owner on that horse, but I have to look back at the picture. I'm not sure who owned what.
Well, so that was the same horse you won your very first race on?
Yes.
Oh, that's very cool. Had to make it that much, you know, that much more special for you, I'm sure. And describe that feeling when you're on a roll like that, and I've never won 5 races in one day, I can tell you that much, but when you're on a roll and you have multiple winners, that high you get, and I think that even helps, your confidence is just out the roof, and those horses can pick up on that too. So describe that feeling that you had that day.
That was so long ago. I don't remember that, but I'm sure that it was. It's a high. It's good. Anytime you're having success, you do. You have that confidence is just there. And like I said about the gait, everything generates, you know, through the horse. The horse, you whatever you're feeling, it somehow goes to the horse's body. It's just like galloping. Before I started riding, I could gallop a very, very tough horse. And once I started riding, I had to work to gallop a tough horse, because when you're riding, you're supposed to be generating that speed, and that stuff is in the back of your mind somewhere, and all that stuff generates through to the horse. And so you have to, I had to naturally try to slow everything down in my mind and through my body so that it would generate to the horse, where it was easier to gallop a tougher horse later.
Yeah, I've experienced that as well, Cheryl. Very well put. And tell me about the day when you decided to retire.
I had been working up to that for a few years. I took my time to come down slowly, mentally. I wanted it to be my own choice, and thank God that I was able to have that opportunity. I also wanted to quit before I became a has-been. And I had other things that I wanted to do. And so it worked out good. It made it where, because I took that time to mentally come down slower, I didn't miss riding, you know, as much as some people do, especially those people like Pinkai and Dominguez that got it jerked out from underneath them because of injury. So I was fortunate in that regard.
Most definitely, Cheryl. And did you suffer injuries throughout your career?
Yeah, you have to. You can't ride for 21 years and not get dazed or get hurt. Mine were not probably as bad as some people. You know, my worst one was probably my hip dislocation. I did land on my head in the parking lot one day that I don't really remember, but I guess that could be construed as a bad one. Lost 3 days of memory on that one. But other stuff, just minor stuff, you know, your collarbone, but separated shoulder and broken ribs and stuff. But I feel that I was pretty fortunate injury-wise. My hip dislocation was the worst, I guess.
And you talked about you were mentally ready when you retired and how difficult it is for people who don't get that opportunity. And I can definitely agree with that. It was not my choice when I retired, and therefore I do miss it, like you just were talking about. And so when you decided to retire and you walked away to do, you know, bigger, better things, you were okay with it. You didn't miss it at all.
No, I didn't miss it at all. And I still gallop every day. I gallop for Baffert and Seiss and a lot of people, you know, at Santa Anita and, you know, and Pomona and up on the fairs. And honestly, to say all the years that I galloped after I retired, I think I've only found two horses that would have brought me out of retirement. And I don't believe that they belong to any super trainer. And I galloped Indy and Charlie for Baffert, and he wasn't one of them. But the one horse that I would have kind of come out of retirement for was actually a thoroughbred that the old Appaloosa trainer had trained, Don
wow.
Collins. So I think that being mentally ready, it just, you know, was good. And like I said, I think not being a has-been, or at least not being a has-been in my mind, helped a lot too, you know.
Definitely. Definitely. And the fact that you still, to this day, you still gallop horses.
No, not now. I'm too fat now. But I haven't galloped anything since the last Lady Legends race.
Lady Legends race. Cheryl, we only have 5 minutes left. This hour's going by fast, but I remember I was riding in Maryland, and I think it was 2013 when they had, I think it was the last Lady Legends race. And I remember that day, and I was there. And tell us about that. They had several of those. And tell us how you first became involved and how you got ready for that.
Well, we got involved with it because Jason Neff and Linda Ellerman were doing the documentary "Lady is a Jock," which I do not believe is still finished. But they brought this idea to Pimlico, and so that's how it ended up getting started. And obviously, it's hard to find actual legends to participate because we were all really old. the actual legends, you know, were Barbara Jo and myself, and Jennifer Rowland was riding when I was riding. And it's just, you know, like the Gwen Jackson won the first one. She rode like 30 years after we did, you know, but she was in the Lady Legends race. So,
right.
But it was fun, and Pimlico treated us very well, and we thank George and Hale and everybody that was involved for that opportunity, because it was a wonderful opportunity and experience, and it was just great.
Yeah, like I said, I remember being there and just looking up to you so much, all of you there.
Did you come over to the infield?
I was riding that day, so I was in the jocks room. Yeah, I was riding that day, and it was the coolest thing to me to watch that. And how did you get fit for? I guess you were galloping horses every day at that point.
Yeah, I still galloped, and I was still galloping anyway at Pleasanton. After they closed Pomona, it made me shift north. But, yeah, I was galloping all the time anyway. Barbara Jo, and she still rides her a lot of horses at her place for dressage, which you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Jennifer probably, she went to Laurel, I think, to get ready. And Mary's husband, they have horses in Florida, so she was still galloping, I think, a little bit anyway. So, but... Yeah, I don't know. It just...
Was it cool to be there with so many other women who you've known for so long and rode with? Was it cool to be there with them for that?
Oh, yeah, it was a great experience, and we had a lot of fun, and we got to know people that we, you know, that you hadn't known, you knew of, but didn't know, and so it was really cool, and it was great. And Keeneland invited us one year over there for a day, too, and they treated us well. I wish they'd have done that another time or two. It was a lot of fun, and tons of women came for that also. So it's been a really good experience.
Will there be any other Lady Legends races in the future, Cheryl?
I would not expect Legends. I mean, if you want to say Legends, because to me the Legends would be people that rode, say, like in the first 5 years of when women were allowed to ride. And that's, I think now we're getting past the, you know, like say Barbara's 65 or 66, you know. And, I mean, people that rode in the first 5 years of when women were allowed to ride are probably getting to the age, that, not to mention where they're not involved with horses like some of us are or were. And so I don't think Legends would be the proper thing. They may come up with, you know, some other race, you know, that involves.
Well, we can sure hope.
Prominent women in the industry,
right.
But not Legends.
We can sure hope so, Cheryl. And I'm so glad I was able to see it. And Cheryl, thank you so much for doing this show with us and wishing you all the best in the future.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And it's been a good experience, I hope.
It was a lot of fun, Cheryl.
Good. Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you. Folks, if you missed any portion of tonight's show, you can check out our website, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. While you're there, check out all of the other great shows you can listen to. Don't forget, join me and Big A, Anthony Stabile, tomorrow at 3 o'clock Eastern Time. We will bring you 3 hours of live racing coverage right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.